Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Vicki Winterton from Right Now Radio, a member of Expert Insights Publishing Family. And we're proud to announce that we've published 9 new number one bestsellers in just the last year and created 300 new best-selling authors. Our latest bestseller, Wounded, Survive, Thrive, is getting rave reviews around the globe, and that's why I wanted to bring this to you. Each of us can think of a woman in our life that, despite her trials and adversity, seemed to pick herself up, dust herself off, and pull herself together. This book is an invaluable resource and a collection of 101 women's stories from tears and torment to triumph. This will leave an indelible imprint on your heart forever. These resilient women have lived through nightmares and not only survived, but found ways to truly thrive. For the next few weeks, we will showcase raw interviews and powerful testimonies of their struggles, which only have made them stronger. Surviving some of the most difficult situations taught these brave women resilience, strength, and faith, and they want to share that with you now. Discover their triumph. Hi, Diane. I'm so thrilled that you could join us for the book, Wounded, Survive, Thrive. And I'm just really thrilled that you'll be sharing your story that can possibly impact women all over the world who really need to hear it now. So welcome, Diane.
Thank you. I'm excited about this as well.
So tell me a little bit about how you have experienced being wounded or challenged in the past, Miss Diane Hart, and how that has impacted you. Tell me a little bit about what that looked like for you when that was going on.
Well, in January 10th of 2005, I was the last survivor rescued alive from the massive La Conchita landslide that killed 10 people and destroyed 27 homes and buried them.
Oh, my gosh.
I was buried alive 30 feet deep for 4.5 hours, packed in with just a 2-foot by 2-foot airspace, and I lost everything I had. I lost my life as I knew it and everything. There was the only thing that I had under that ground was my consciousness. My body was even useless. I was helpless in the situation that I was in, and all I had was my spiritual consciousness to rely on, and that's all that was left, and that was all that was important. I went through a process of, I went through judgment of my life. I went through a lot of thoughts of what the priorities in life are, what kind of legacy I might lead, the life I had lived. Ooh, if I survived, how would it be different? I just lost a train of thought here.
This is like incredible. I had no idea that a landslide was part of your story where you were trapped without anything other than a 2-foot space, a breathing space. Tell me how, I'd love to share with readers how this built up. I mean, were you just in your house and all of a sudden it happened?
I was in my house. My thought that I lost was into my injuries. I was severely injured. All of my ribs, 12 of my ribs were broken in multiple places, 3 of my vertebrae, my right scapula. My left arm was crushed. I feared losing my left hand because it was painfully numb, so I knew that it wasn't getting circulation or something. And my head was packed in. I had head trauma. My stomach was cut open. And I literally could not move other than I could wave my right hand in front of my face, about 3 inches. And that was it. I was in my house. Now, La Conchita had a history of landslides. And there was one in 95 that buried 7 homes, but nobody was injured or killed. Everybody was warned and got out of the house. And then there were meetings and plans to stabilize the mountain. And, of course, all of us in town felt that the authorities were doing the right thing. And actually what they did was the wrong things and made the saturation of the water worse of the mountain. So we didn't we had a false sense of security going on, whereas they knew within 3 or 4 days before it came down that there was problems and it was getting serious, and they never warned anybody to get out of town. So everybody was going about their business, even though it was a heavy rain. There had been a landslide across Highway 101 just west of town, which is kind of northwest, and cars were stuck in the mud and helicopters were rescuing people. So there was a dramatic scene going on with the rain and the mudslide before the mountain came down. But we figured with so many authorities in the area and they knew the history of the mountain that we would be warned. And we weren't. In fact, people who even wanted to leave town weren't allowed to. So they'd closed the highway and closed town, basically. So I had gone out and watched the rescue on Highway 101 and then went back home about noon, ate some lunch, and I had been on vacation for a week in Yosemite with my sister-in-law, and had just come back that weekend and was supposed to go back to work that Monday, and it was a Monday that the mountain came down, and I couldn't get to work because of the closure of the highway. So at noon, I just had all this work piled up from a week of being off, and I had to get on the computer. I was trademarked Ask Diane. I was the it girl to go to for breast implant information. I founded a department of patient information at the corporation that manufactured breast implants, and having been a surgical nurse for 20 years and specialized in plastic surgery the last 8, I had knowledge and just approached the company when the silicon controversy erupted. And they went for my idea of forming this professional information department, and it became very successful to the point where I was trademarked and I was getting hundreds of emails and calls, and I had built it up to a staff of 3 nurses and an administrator. And so I had all these emails, a couple hundred emails to catch up on. And I started working after I ate my lunch, and about an hour into it, my cat came up to me, and I was actually on my last email of my private corporate emails, and then I was going to go to my Ask Diane site that had another 100 in it. But my cat wouldn't let me work. He was batting my hands off the keyboard and meowing and batting my head, and he was just going frantic on me to the point where all I had to do was punch a few keys, and I could send that email, and that was difficult. So I closed my laptop, and I said, okay, what's wrong? And I got up and tried to pet him, and he batted me again and meowed and jumped off the daybed and ran to the side door, and I got up and walked about 6 feet, and I saw him looking at me like, hurry up. He was pacing like, hurry up, get out the door. And just then I stopped in my tracks, and throughout, I could look through my house to my front window, and I saw two 20-year-old twins, Annie and Bree, that I'd known all their life, running past my front window, frantically looking behind them over their right shoulder. And I instantly knew it was the mountain coming down. And a nanosecond later, my house, the bathroom right next to me, about 10 feet away, started crushing in, and the breaking of the glass and the wood and the iron from the shower and everything was just this. It was the first noise I heard, and it was really frightening and loud. And I had a nanosecond to think of what to do. Of course, my first thought was, God, help me through this. And my second one is, this is too big. I'm going to die. And then the ceiling started coming in, and I had prepared a coat closet that I happened to be about 4 or 5 feet from, because the cat had gotten up off my L-shaped desk. I was on the other side of that desk, closer to the closet. And I had padded it with blankets and pillows that morning because my son had called me at 6 a.m. and said we had a strange tornado warning and to make a safe place in the house. So I thought of it, and I ran to it, and I grabbed inside a coat. As the house was coming down on me, my feet did not get in the closet, but my upper body did. So as the house came down, I was pushed prone as the closet collapsed on me and started to basically body surf that mountain slide as it continued in its path. The fireplace, locked fireplace, was behind me, and that sort of covered me, which was kind of good because it protected me from the mud, but it was rocks that covered me and followed me in this body surfing about 40 to 50 feet as I went through my house, through a wood fence, and through the house next door. I ended up in their kitchen. That's where I got cut up. And both houses were crushed at the same time and turned into sticks and broken boards. And both houses were also pushed out into the middle of the street at the same time. The mountain suddenly stopped, and I got a glimpse of the ocean and the sky, this beautiful scenery. And my neighbor in the house that I had been pushed into, he was arced out his window head first. And the next nanosecond, I knew, I sensed that the mountain was going to compress down. And I braced up my back, and I was an avid swimmer. For 8 years, I swam laps for an hour twice a week, so I was strong and toned. And I just braced up my back, and with all my physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual strength, everything I had, I just went, "You're not going to kill me." And it was the emotion and went all the way up to the heavens, like I was connecting to God at the same time, "You're not going to kill me," to the mountain. And it came bang down on me with the force of dropping a couple elephants on you. And it flipped me on my side, so I ended up laying on my right side. And when I had put my arms together, when I braced my back up and put my hands together to make that brace, that's how I created my little airspace. So that's the only airspace I had. Once the mountain crushed me, my lungs collapsed. I couldn't breathe. And so that was the first thing I needed to do. And as a nurse, I knew I had to massage my lungs to inflate them again, so I made my chest muscles move my rib cage and my chest bone up and down like I was giving myself CPR, and at the same time gasping for any air that I could squeak into my lungs. And it took the longest time. I was at the point where I didn't think I was going to be successful. And finally, I was able to get a little air in, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more, until my lungs finally inflated and relaxed into somewhat of a normal breathing. Then I pushed, because it was like, okay, what am I dealing with? And I pushed and realized I was so solidly packed in, and I sensed that I was really deep. And I went into a full-on panic. I wanted to push that mountain out of the way. I wanted to be back in my office on my cozy day bed with my cat. I just couldn't believe this had happened, and I just wanted it to go away and take back those 8 seconds. The mountain came down in only 8 seconds. And I realized that this wasn't going to work. I said, "Stop it, Diane. Panic is not going to help. It's not going to get you out of here. You cannot push this mountain off of you. You are physically helpless." And I thought, what can I do with this panic? And I threw it into prayer, and I just prayed my heart out like I had never prayed in my entire life. And I went through judgment. The bad of my life went before my eyes, the times I'd been unethical, immoral, or hurt people, and I felt that pain, and I felt remorse for that. And then I went through the good things in my life and realized how I'd overcome so many difficulties in life to become a bigger success than me or anybody that ever knew me thought I would be. And in that success, I had helped hundreds of thousands of women. In 15 years, I counseled one-on-one approximately 300,000 women. And that doesn't count my writings, my speeches, and the other nurses and that I trained and that worked for me. So I just, that was a big satisfaction, and I had a family that and a lot of love in my life, and I realized that I was basically a good person and worthy of God. And with that thought and that realization, I went into this vortex in space that was my consciousness became huge. Being deprived and void of everything sensory, everything I was, everything gone, there was nothing left but my consciousness. And it became so huge that it was comforting because it was all I needed. It was all that was important. It was all knowing. It was all everlasting. It's all that mattered. And it was only part of this bigger consciousness that was so incredibly amazing that it gave me a trepidation about it. And then I came back from that, and I had a peace about me. I had a true inner peace like I'd never felt before in my whole life. This worst day of my life, lost everything, underground, in agony, absolute agony I didn't think I could bear. I got peaceful. And I looked around and thought, okay, what am I dealing with? 2 feet of air. And I had hollered for help a few times. Other people were yelling, but all their voices were muffled. So I realized I couldn't waste my energy and my breath yelling. I had to wait until somebody was close enough to hear me. Just wait. So to conserve my air, I put myself in a meditative state. I had done a lot of yoga, and, you know, I was an exercise fanatic, and so I loved yoga, so I put myself in this meditative state and lowered my body's metabolism and its requirement for oxygen, and I went deeper and deeper and deeper into this relaxed, peaceful, almost hibernative meditative state, and I just stayed there, just using as little oxygen as I could. I later found out that I made that oxygen last 9 times longer than the normal person would have based on tests that they've done with airspace and how long a person can be in an airspace. So I got a little bit of brain damage from that lack of oxygen because it was an hour and a half before they found me, and I had run out of air and was starting to pass out. But I would have been severely brain damaged or dead if I hadn't have lowered my body's need for oxygen like I did. So then
that
when they found
amazing.
Me, I know, it was like I could not, I still can't believe it happened to me, really.
Wow.
But yeah, so, and what they weren't really looking for me. They were concentrating on trying to find the 3 children and the mother that died in that tragedy. And there were 3 little kids, like, you know, a baby and a toddler and a, you know, 3 or 4-year-old and the mother, and they were all found together and died during that. And they were right next door to me. So they thought that I had not survived because I was so deep. They just didn't have any hope that I had survived that. So they just weren't paying attention to me. And a friend went through a police blockade on Highway 101 and went up to the captain and said, I think I know where she is. You need to look for her. If anybody would have survived that, she would have. And so the captain said okay, and they crawled into kind of a little space that was triangular in front of my crushed car and made their way, and then they got into this sort of big open pocket of space, and that was the first non-muffled sound I heard. I heard the stomping of the footsteps really close to me, and then I heard my name being called, and I was passing out, so I yelled help, but it was too weak and soft for them to hear me, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to be able to yell louder, and I didn't know if I could do it. So I took all the strength I had and yelled, help, I'm here. And they heard me, and the captain came up and started talking to me about rescuing me and what they needed to do and that it would take several hours because I was so deep. And then we talked about taking me out from underneath or from above, and I kept saying, please don't take me out from underneath. I'm afraid things will shift, and I'm so injured that any movement could kill me. And then they assessed the situation and agreed with me, and they had to go in, even though underneath was probably the shorter and easier way, it was the more dangerous. And so they had to make like a mine shaft that went down 30 feet through the mud, and the broken boards and everything they had to cut through to make this square shaft. And they put plywood, you know, so the mud wouldn't cave in as they went down. and they had like a bucket brigade, a big long, you know, 20-man bucket brigade, passing the buckets along as they were digging. And they piped in air. That was one of the first things, and I felt it swoosh in like it had come into a vacancy quickly. And they had microphones that they had lowered so they could talk to me through it, everything, and ask me questions and let me know what they were doing. And then I heard the continual sound of electric saws as they were sawing through boards to get, you know, that tunnel carved down. And finally I felt somebody at my feet, my lower leg. The hot water heater had fallen near my foot, and I could barely move it like an inch just to get it out from under that hot water. And that's about where the fireman came down first. And he didn't see me, and I suddenly could move that top leg. And I still had a blanket wrapped around me, I realized, when I moved my knee up and down. And I said, you're here, I'm here. And all of a sudden I heard him say, I see movement, and yelled it up at the top, and everybody said, all right. And so he started, you know, then he heard me talking, and he asked me how I was positioned and where he should start uncovering me from. So I told him to start uncovering from the back, from my back, and my arm was kind of fell, and he caught it because it was so broken, it just fell. You know, the broken piece just hung down all of a sudden, and he had to catch it back up. And he put a splint on that, and then he put a collar when he got up to my neck and freed my head. He put a neck collar on me and then a back brace. And the back brace was a board that was, I was strapped to it, and it had the ropes that went up to the top. And he said, okay, we're going to have to hoist you up with this. And he goes, it's going to be painful, but we'll make it quick. And I said, okay. And they pulled me up, and as they pulled me up, it was the strangest thing to watch the sides of that carved out mud, and then for my head to come up out of the hole of the opening and see all the firemen and the lights, and there were news cameras. And I just went, this is a miracle. I couldn't believe that I was out. I had survived this. It was so incredibly against all odds.
And amazing.
Yeah. So then they put me on my stretcher, and, you know, my friend said, we got you. And they were deciding whether to take me by helicopter or ambulance, and I wanted to go by ambulance because I thought the helicopter might be too jerky and I couldn't take any movement. I was in so much agony. And they said that they could go by ambulance. The highway had been cleared, and I wanted to go to Santa Barbara because I knew people in the medical profession. I'd worked at Cottage Hospital 20 years earlier in the operating room, and gone to school with the girl that was the director of the emergency room. She was my study buddy when I got my Bachelor of Science degree, which I went back in my 40s to get. And so sure enough, she was there, Denise, and when I got to the ER, and she comforted me, and she made sure I got the right surgeon for my arm, and then I got into surgery right away. And boy, going under anesthesia was the most welcome thing. I was never so glad to go under anesthesia in my whole life. It was like, put me out of this pain. And so, and then when I woke up, it was not as bad. You know, they had me on all kinds of narcotics and pain medication, all kinds of stuff. So it was just, but then it was a long recovery. I couldn't move anything. I had to be totally taken care of. My hair had to be washed, but I had to be bathed by someone else. I had to, the first time I got up, I could only sit in a chair 5 minutes, and my back would go into spasms that were just so horrible. I couldn't hold myself up. So it was a long recovery, and
How long was your recovery?
Well, I lived with my son. He prepared one of his extra bedrooms for me. He made it so beautiful. He went out and bought curtains that were dark so I could sleep in the day, and a nice bedspread, and put pictures that my grandchildren had drawn on the wall. He framed them nicely to match the room, and went in the garage and got a collage I had given him of his childhood when he'd moved out of the house and put that up. That brought tears to my eyes. Still does when I talk about it.
my God.
And anyway, they took such good care of me, and my daughter-in-law was just a saint. She would give me my bath. First she'd do the two boys, and then she'd do me and tell me I was just about the same size. And I started going to physical therapy for my hand because my fingers didn't work. My hand was completely stiff, so I had about 5 or 6 months of intense physical therapy to be able to use my hand, my left hand. And then I kind of did my own therapy for a while, having been into exercise and a nurse. I could only do limited things. I had to start slow getting myself, you know, back into any form of exercise. All my forms were back at beginner level. And I'm still working on that. But I've made progress. I've made a lot of progress. I swim once a week for half an hour, and I do my yoga, and I go for a walk several times a week, and I'm a fast walker. And, you know, so I'm back to doing all of those things that I love in the physical, and my health is much better. And, you know, most of the time people think I'm normal, but I have normal days, and then I have to crash and make up for it. I don't have the normal, I get fatigued easily. And then the mental thing, I couldn't read a book for 4 years, so I had to keep trying and trying, and anything that required that kind of cognitive work was really difficult for me. I thought it was post-traumatic stress, and I just recently found out that there's a separation between the post-traumatic stress, which is my anxiety that is kind of goes out of control easily, and my lack of oxygen that and small amount of brain damage, which is the cognitive function. So finding that out helped me to work with it better, and knowing that I have to work at the cognitive function even if I don't feel like it, because that's what's going to regrow those memories and those synapses. And so at first I couldn't read a book for 4 years. Now I can read books just like I used to. And, you know, now I'm working on being able to get on the computer more often, because that's just, I used to work on the computer all day long, and now I have this all anxiety about getting on it for 10 minutes just to check my emails. So, and I thought it was post-traumatic stress, so I go, well, I think I'm going to wait for my post-traumatic stress to be better. Now I know it's not that. It's my cognitive. I've got to get on it, even if it's for 5 minutes, to retrain my brain. So, so I've made, and I've written this book. I wrote a book about my experiences, and with Jennifer, we've been a couple years putting together a marketing plan and a website, and we're right at the point of sending out proposals. So I'm very excited. That's the other thing I'm doing, is I'm staying engaged and with life and moving forward. I can't work as a nurse anymore. I'm on Social Security disability. For the post-traumatic stress of the injuries and everything. But it's okay. I have a great sense of accomplishment of what I did as a nurse, far beyond what I ever hoped and dreamed for in my life. And that's over. And, you know, I've learned to leave the past in the past and live in the present and have a hopeful future. And, you know, what I did in my career, even though I loved it and fought giving it up, I tried to go back to work afterwards and just it didn't work. So I really tried to hang on to that. I loved my career so much, but it was time to give it up, and it was what I did. It wasn't me. You know, it's just something I did, and now I'm doing something else. I'm doing something different. But I'm still being engaged and active and, you know, having a hopeful future.
That's fantastic. And I have to ask you something. Did you have any anger coming out of this with the officials or anyone who could have done maybe a better job and avoided some of this? Was there anger there?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, there's anger there. And I think not so much for me, because I've almost looked at my experience now, having some distance from it, some time from it, as a blessing that gave me so much more. It took a lot from me, but it also gave me so much more, especially in my spiritual being and my ability to weather storms in life and keep my peace. I struggle now to keep my peace that I gained that day. I kept it really good for about a year and a half, and then life started chipping away at it. I just gained so much from that experience that I don't, there's no anger for me. There's anger for those three little children and their mother that lost their lives because these officials didn't take the responsibility they were in the position to do. And then they denied it and tried to blame everybody in town for living there. Like, what is everybody supposed to do, walk away from their mortgages because it may happen someday, maybe not for 100 years, like the earthquake in Los Angeles. You know, is everybody supposed to move out because the earthquake's coming someday? And it was the same scenario. And yet when it all happened, they denied their part in it and tried to blame the people in town for merely living there. So I was disappointed in a lot of what I saw in the legal system, unfortunately. We won against the La Conchita Ranch. We won the case on that, but the Ventura County skirted every, they just got out of the whole thing. They, you know, we couldn't even sue them after a while. It was denied, denied, denied. And they had built the wall with no drainage.
So are you to a place where you're somewhat at peace with that now?
Sure. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, it was done. It's done. Yeah. Yeah, I think all my anger got out in the court. I spent a whole summer in court on that. And that was sort of where I realized the negligence and went through my anger period during the court case. And then after the court case, it was like, okay, it's done. Leave it behind. Move on.
Mm. So what does life looks really beautiful for you now from the standpoint of your perception of where you're at? For someone who maybe has gone through something that they look at as a tremendous loss, for you it was a tremendous loss of everything and a huge time of recovering what you've been able to recover, and you've come out so positive about that. What would you advise for someone who's not yet at the place where they can look at a huge loss like that as a positive? What is there something that you could help them with to put them into action, to think more positively about maybe an event that would be perceived as negative by the majority of us?
Well, I think there's sort of a universal order to life, and we can't prevent the storms and the, you know, difficulties entering our life. The only thing we can control is our own reaction to it and our own attitude toward it. And if we let it turn us bitter or angry, we're sort of cutting off our nose to spite our face and setting ourselves up for unhappiness and letting the physical world control our happiness or our joy. Our joy is something that comes from within. And one of the things I experienced under that mountain was physical losses are just stuff. It's stuff. It has no real substance. The substance in life is each person's consciousness, their spiritual consciousness, their attitude, what they do with their life, how they live their life, how they treat others, the higher principles in life, or what really matter, love in our life, those kinds of virtues, gifts, those are what really have meaning. Stuff is just stuff. Money's just money. We need it for security to live comfortably, but you can always replace it. You can always get some from somewhere else again. Whereas if you lose your spirit, your positive attitude, and you become bitter and angry, it's hard to get that back, and it does real damage to the being within, the soul, and it affects everybody around you.
Well,
a positive attitude affects everybody positively. And okay,
Diane, I've got to tell you, this has been an unbelievable story, and I am just so thrilled again that you're going to be telling this in the book, because this is incredible, really incredible. And to come out the other side experiencing all that you experienced with the ability for forgiveness and the ability to look at the positive side of life and really with a huge appreciation for what you're left with and to be looked at it as almost a gift, that is That's incredible. And I'm just blown away by the interview. It's been amazing. Amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Vicki. You made it easy.
And I have to say, I can't wait till your book comes out to tell your story in a more full way, because I think that this is something people really need to hear. And sometimes things happen to us that are very exaggerated, so other people will too learn lessons that they need to know. And this is just really quite an incredible one. Really amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I realize that I inspired people, you know, somewhere along the way within the first year or two. But then there, you know, I had to deal with life issues, you know, the legal thing and, you know, putting my life back together, and had to deal with those real life issues for a while. And then when they were done, you know, I got into a more peaceful, normal, you know, coasting through life again, and everything was a little more routine, and I got out in the world and was talking, and the more people I talked to, the more people told me I was an inspiration to them and that I needed to write the book. And I had written another book that never got published about 30 years ago, and I had published articles in my journal, nursing journal, during my nursing career, and numerous newsletter articles. But it was logical for me to go to the book. And so I thought, okay, I felt it as a responsibility that if I inspire people talking to a stranger in a grocery store for 5 minutes, and other people are telling me I need to tell more people this, then I need to accept that responsibility seriously and do what I can to help people by my experience. So that's when I got serious about the book and about a speaking career, and I've been 3 years working on it now. So hopefully ready to launch it any time.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. Well, thank you so much for your contribution and your time. What is the name of your website?
DianeHartSpeaker.com.
Okay, fantastic thing. Well, thank you again. It's just been, I can't tell you how inspirational the time with you has been. Truly inspirational.
Oh.
And
I'm
so thrilled you're going to be a part of it all.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. I am excited about having this opportunity and being a part of it also.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Have a good evening.
To learn more about Wounded, Survive, Thrive, our other bestsellers, and the opportunity for you as a writer to get published now, visit GetEIP.com. That's GetEIP.com. This is Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Publishing, wishing you a happy and award-winning week. See you next time.